from WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made at a gas pump in central Nebraska, where prices are now below $2 a gallon. It was June 2004 when we first saw gas prices pass the $2 mark in western New York. Today, our gas prices are back down to roughly that same level adjusted for inflation. And yet in the contiguous United States, Rochester, New York has the distinction of offering the highest gas prices. It's true, outside of Hawaii and Alaska, you won't find more expensive gasoline in the country right now than right here in Rochester. Why is that? And is that necessarily a bad thing? Democrat and Chronicle reporter Sean Lehman reported on this issue a few days ago. I've asked him to answer some of the common questions about gas prices. If you want to join the conversation, you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Democrat and Chronicle reporter Sean Lehman, welcome to Connections.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Well, let me also let our listeners know that we have shifted the schedule a bit for today's programming. We had planned first hour to have a discussion about last night's PBS Frontline episode, that Frontline episode focusing on the rise in political power of the NRA. But because of a Time Warner cable outage, a lot of our listeners did not have a chance to see it. So you can see that PBS Frontline episode right now online in its entirety. If you Google PBS Frontline Gunned Down, you can watch the entire hour-long episode now. Or you can also see rebroadcast tonight, two separate airings tonight at 6 o'clock and 9 p.m., 6 and 9 tonight on WXXI World. That's cable 1275 or over the air 21.2. So 1275 on your cable, 6 and 9 tonight, or online on pbs.org right now. Tomorrow in our noon hour, we will have a conversation about that program, The Rise in Political Power of the NRA. We'll have a guest who is concerned about the political power of the NRA, and we will also welcome a guest who supports the NRA and says that they are doing great work and that are often misunderstood. So you can join that conversation tomorrow. All right, gas prices. Sean Lehman, I don't know if you know this, but people get fired up about gas prices. That is no surprise. And so let's start with what's going on now. The average price of a gallon of regular unleaded in New York today around $2.70, national average around $2.19. Why the disparity?
Well, there's a couple of factors that drive that, and you're right. People are asking this question. That's why I looked into it last week. You know, one of the issues that pushes our prices up is gas taxes. We pay about 68 cents a gallon, I think, in taxes. Some of that's federal taxes, some of that's state taxes. That's the highest in the country. And so that is one of the reasons why you see, particularly folks who may have been out during the holidays driving around and see the taxes are much lower in neighboring states like Ohio and Pennsylvania and even down south if they ventured that far. That accounts for about 20 cents a gallon in the price difference we're seeing here in the Northeast. But one of the other factors that we really can't do anything about is just our geography. We're much further away from where the bulk of the crude oil in the U.S. is refined, which is in Texas and Oklahoma. It's actually more expensive to transport oil from Texas to New York than it is for us to buy oil from Europe, from the North Sea, which is the other major supplier, and that the price of the West Texas Intermediate has been significantly lower than the oil we're getting out of the North Sea. So that adds maybe another 20 cents a gallon to the price. And when you narrow in on Rochester and Buffalo, which have been the two highest gas prices in the country over the last few weeks, the other issue is just a lack of competition, frankly. We don't have as many of the big discount chains selling gas here, like Costco, for example, which moved into Syracuse last year. And when those folks drop their prices, it really forces everybody else to do that. But we have fewer wholesalers here, which means there's not as much incentive to drop the prices. And, you know, that probably adds about another 20 cents a gallon to what we're paying at the pump.
Talking to Sean Lehman, reporter for the Democrat and Chronicle. Now, there is a Costco coming to the Citygate project in Rochester, right?
There is.
And that's on target. I don't have offhand the targeted opening for that. But of course, that could impact prices at least to some small degree.
It could. And what happened in Syracuse, they opened a Costco, I think it opened in October in one of the suburbs of Syracuse. And they right out of the gate, were selling gas at about 15 cents a gallon less than people right across the street. And, you know, consumers took notice of that. And the folks down the street and a few miles away, they really didn't have a choice but to respond and to drop their price as well, even if it meant selling gas at a loss. And that's what happened. And so that's one of the reasons why, not just in suburban Syracuse, but throughout that part of the state, we see gas prices are coming down.
Sean talked about geography, and he mentioned Texas and Oklahoma as sort of geographical advantage states for the cost of gasoline, if you'd like to see it lower. And Texas and Oklahoma, right there around $2 a gallon right now. And again, we're up around $2.75 in Rochester. It's not hard to find individual gas pumps in Texas, Oklahoma, Nebraska that are under $2 now. And so, yeah, again, you know, it's interesting, Sean, that there are some people who are frustrated that Rochester's prices are so high. And yet, on Twitter this morning, in preparation for this program, I asked Rochesterians what you think about some of these prices, and the comments were not exactly what I expected. I want to read some of them. Okay. Jason writes to us, gas prices are artificially low in Rochester and across America. We don't pay for the negatives of a car-based transport system, choose a location and a lifestyle where car use is minimized and gas prices don't bother you as much. That's what Jason writes. Peter writes, we only know they are high if we are constantly reminded that we can buy cheaper gas in a place that we don't live. Adrian says it's super cheap. I don't understand the anger. But then you've got people like Jenna saying, I feel helpless about gas prices. Andy says he's annoyed. Brian says it's still infinitely cheaper than it was months ago, and I used to live in Europe, so it still seems insanely cheap. Dennis writes, gas prices are too low. They don't cover road maintenance costs, and they encourage sprawl, which is way more expensive over time. And finally, Chris writes to us, I don't compare the cost of milk in Rochester to the cost of milk in Iowa because the entire economy is different. So sort of a variety of perspectives there. But one of the common themes, Sean, is that we can be a little tunnel vision when it comes to gas prices. And when you do look at Europe and you look at the rest of the world, we are still paying a lot less.
That is true. And I, you know, in fairness, gas prices have dropped here by more than a dollar a gallon since May. And it's hard to be unhappy about that. But, you know, in Europe, they do pay two to three times as much as what we pay at the pump. It's all driven by taxes, and they use those taxes not only to fund things like highway maintenance, which is, you know, maybe something we ought to consider here, but also as a way to encourage people to use mass transit and not to drive as much. A lot of that's a cultural difference. That, you know, I think, you know, people here like driving their cars. We've maybe moved away from single drivers and SUVs when the gas prices got up to close to $4 a gallon. But that is true. And, you know, while our gas prices are high here, you know, we have some lower prices in a lot of different areas. Real estate's a lot less expensive here, for example, the cost of living than living in New York City. So, maybe a fair point that we do have tunnel vision, but it's a price that we all look at every time, you know, we pull up to fill up our tank.
Talking to Sean Lehman, reporter for the Democrat and Chronicle, who's been covering this gas price issue. And Sean, I know in your work that is published not only in the print edition, but online, there's plenty of discussion with readers of the Democrat and Chronicle, whether it's on your social media or in comment section. What's some of the feedback you've gotten on this issue? Is it sort of a cross-section that way? Is there a lot of frustration that Rochester is paying the most?
It is. I think there's been a mix. As you say, some people who say, you know, gee, we really don't have it too bad, even though we are paying more than any other city. The other thing I heard that's really interesting is there's a lot of, we talk about the average price, but there's a lot of variation in the price of what different stations just around town are charging. And if you look at the at AAA's website or a site like GasBuddy.com, which track this prices every day at a variety of stations. You know, you can see some stations in town selling for maybe 20 cents over the local average, some selling for maybe 20 cents under. Some of that's geographic, some of that's, you know, just the nature of running a gasoline station. You pay a certain price when you fill up, you know, you buy thousands of gallons of gas at a time, and if the prices drop over the next week before you sold that, you know, you're kind of stuck at what you paid for it. So I think one of the things that folks can understand is that there's a big variety, a big variation in what the price at the pump is, you know, across just Monroe County.
Sean, we've had some questions from listeners about tax policy when it comes to gas prices. So I just want to read briefly here. I'm looking at the list of states that are in the Northeast that aren't far away from us, because, again, New York State around $2.70 a gallon, Rochester around $2.75 right now, the highest in the country. Pennsylvania is around $2.50 a gallon, Massachusetts about $2.40. Delaware, $2.35, Maine, $2.35, New Jersey's down at about $2.19 a gallon. And questions regarding whether there is any sort of a movement to cap gas taxes. But of those gas taxes that you've been talking about, again, they break down in different ways, and I don't know how much lower state or county could make that price, Sean.
Well, that's a tough question. About, we pay 68 cents a gallon in taxes in New York State. About 20 cents of that is a federal tax, so everybody's paying that. And then we have the other 50 cents or so is state tax. I haven't heard anybody who says they want to lower that tax. Any legislators who've talked about that? And you know, it's certainly the issue of taxation here is one that folks are always complaining about. But, you know, right across the border into Massachusetts, they're paying maybe 20 cents less a gallon in gas taxes. So, you know, it's certainly one of the things that's helping keep those prices high.
And to be clear, Sean, you and I are not in the business of making predictions about what state legislatures will do. But the movement to at least the discussion around rolling back a state gas tax, even 2 or 4 cents a gallon, those kind of discussions have happened, I'm trying to remember, 2011, 2007, at times when gas prices were spiking, not when gas prices are plunging. So it's very unlikely we'd see that now, don't you think?
Exactly. And frankly, there's been a lot, you know, some of that money goes into the general fund. Some of the excise tax has more specific purposes. And I just think politically that would be a tough thing to pull off.
Before I let you go, a couple other quick points here. Aren't you glad you don't have to be in the business of trying to figure out how much President Obama deserves credit for this? It's really remarkable in American politics that in every election cycle, you had Newt Gingrich saying that if President Obama was reelected, that gas prices would be at $8 to $10 a gallon. They're not. You had Newt Gingrich saying that if he were elected, he'd get gas prices down to $1.50. And now Newt Gingrich does not want to give the president any credit, but I'm not sure the president deserves any credit, nor did I think the president deserved much blame before. And again, I know that's not necessarily your bailiwick, but isn't it sort of a funny symptom of American voters that we want to ascribe a lot of blame there?
We do, and you know, I think that probably the president wishes he had that kind of control over the economy.
Sure.
There are forces way beyond anybody's control that are not only impacting local prices, but behind, you know, the drop in overall price. I mean, the price of crude oil was $110 a barrel over the summer. It's down around 50. That's not something that's happened because of politicians. That's something that's happened because of the marketplace.
Absolutely. And last question for you, Sean. When it comes to the state of gas taxes, as you've said, New York State, highest gas taxes in the country, and yet we still have questions, as just about everybody does, when it comes to infrastructure, fixing bridges, repairing roads, and how to pay for that, et cetera. I've talked to economists locally and nationally who do think we need to have much more aggressive gas taxes, whether now or in the future, to help not only to help pay for infrastructure improvements and to sort of really re-strengthen American bridges, for example, but also to try to impact behavior, to try to get people to drive less, to burn less fossil fuel, to burn fewer fossil fuels, and to think more about alternative energy. I don't know that there's an appetite now, but I wouldn't be surprised in the future if we saw discussion of a more aggressive gas tax as opposed to lowering them. What do you think?
I think so, too. And I think the key there would really be tying the tax to a specific use. If the money's just going to go into the general fund, there's probably not going to be a lot of support about that. But we've heard a lot about crumbling infrastructure, particularly the bridges, but also roads and highways. They're expensive to maintain, and we don't have the money to do the kind of repairs that are needed.
Sean, great work in the Democrat and Chronicle, and thanks for taking a few minutes for our listeners this afternoon.
Always glad to talk to you, Evan.
Sean Lehman from the Democrat and Chronicle, reporting on this and many other issues. You can find his work in the print edition, of course, and on democratandchronicle.com. We've got a lot to cover this hour, and later in the hour, I don't know if you've been hearing the story recently about Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver's legal situation. There are some questions about whether Sheldon Silver's actions have aided clients of his second firm. And it is a murky situation, but privately, we're hearing a lot of rumblings that there is a real thought that Sheldon Silver might be on shaky ground. Later this hour, we're going to hear from a reporter for Capital NY who's been covering that story. But before we even get there, let me turn to one of my colleagues in studio. It's Michelle Faust. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
Nice to see you back here in studio. It was just 24 hours ago you were on this program.
You just can't get enough of
me. I can't. I feel like we never talk anymore.
Exactly.
Michelle has been leading our efforts in many ways and focusing on health care, the Affordable Care Act, and related issues. And what's on the radar now?
Well, we've been talking about this for quite some time. People who listen to this show, they definitely know that WXXI has this multi-platform reporting project entitled Understanding the Affordable Care Act. And it's all about that. We have national and state news about health care, this law, and how it affects your insurance coverage. We have plenty online. It's on WXXI TV's news magazine, Need to Know, and right here on WXXI Radio. You hear it on Morning Edition. You hear it on Connections, Healthy Friday when we're here, and on All Things Considered. Now, I spoke the other day with Donna Frescatore. She's the executive director of the New York State of Health Benefits Exchange and kind of got an update about what's happening in this open enrollment, because we're still in open enrollment. There was a deadline on December 20th to have coverage that started January 1st. That deadline has passed, but we still have other deadlines that are coming up, and the last day to enroll during open enrollment is February 15th. So we're just kind of getting an update, some new numbers of what's going on, and just how they're planning to make this open enrollment finish well.
All right, so let's listen to that conversation, then we'll come back out and talk more about how our listeners can continue to interact with the program and learn more about what's going on with the Affordable Care Act.
It's important to note that enrollment continues through February 15th for coverage in calendar year 2015. So we encourage people to come in, see what the marketplace has to offer, but they have some time to still get coverage for 2015. We are busy. The marketplace continues to enroll people in affordable coverage every day. Our customer service center is available to assist consumers in shopping for health plans. We have some new tools, including a view plan tool that allows people to do some window shopping before they apply. And our community assisters are available, too, to meet with individuals in person to help them apply for coverage and select a health plan for 2015.
Now, it's expected that when you come up on a deadline like we had mid last month, that you get a lot more traffic. I think you said one of the busiest days was the day right before the deadline in your phone bank. Are we seeing a bit of a drop off since then? Do we expect to have a big surge towards the end of February or mid-February?
Our enrollment is pretty steady, but we do expect and we are ready for a surge as we reach our next deadline, which is January 15th for coverage starting on February 1st, and then the final deadline for enrolling in coverage in 2015, which is February 15th. So we encourage folks who are ready to come in and shop to do that now so we can begin the process of assisting them in both the application and reviewing health plans.
I don't think it was surprising during the first open enrollment that the majority of the people who enrolled were enrolling in Medicaid. But I was a little bit surprised by the numbers that came out last month that showed that the majority of people who enrolled continue to be people in Medicaid enrollees. Do you think that there's something that's contributing to that factor of so many people who still hadn't gotten signed up for Medicaid?
Well, New York State of Health offers one-stop shopping for New Yorkers. So all people who reside in New York can come to the Marketplace online, call our customer service center, or meet with a sister and complete their application. And depending on their family circumstances, the family size, and their income, they'll know right away whether they're eligible for Medicaid or for coverage through a qualified health plan, and if they are eligible for financial assistance, the amount of that financial assistance that will help them reduce their monthly premium costs for coverage that's available only through the Marketplace. So we will continue to enroll, and we will have additional information and enrollment counts in the near future.
Do we have any idea, though, why so many people are coming into Medicaid? Because if they qualified all along, you know, that's a pretty easy enrollment, that they're not being charged out of pocket for that. Do you think that people maybe didn't realize that they were going to be able to get that assistance and thought that there was going to be money out of their pocket?
Well, we certainly have a process now that is easier for people to apply for coverage and enroll in coverage, and we'll work to continue to make certain that New Yorkers are aware of that. In fact, in the upcoming weeks, we will be continuing our Sign Up New York tour. We will be in 13 shopping malls throughout New York State, including shopping malls in the Rochester area starting this weekend. And our sisters will be there to help consumers starting on Friday at 1 p.m. through 7, on Saturday from 12 to 6, and on Sunday from 11 to 5. So we have our certified assisters will be available on site to provide information, to do a financial screening for individuals to see if they're eligible for financial assistance, and if the consumer would like to make a follow-up appointment where they can apply for coverage.
Now, are we seeing a trend of certain types of questions that you're getting through the phone bank or to assisters, something that's coming up more than once?
People are asking about their eligibility for financial assistance through the Marketplace, and what we saw in our first year is that 75% of the people who qualified for coverage through a qualified health plan qualified for financial assistance that helps them reduce their monthly payment for their insurance. We also have questions from people about the number of plans and the types of health plans that they can choose from, and also about how they can apply and where they can make an appointment to work with someone in person.
There's been some conversation about consumers this year being a little bit more educated, having a little bit more understanding of what health insurance is. Are we seeing that trend play out as people are signing up?
We think we are. We think that certainly through the education and outreach efforts, through opportunities like this to tell New Yorkers about the Marketplace in New York State, that it's provided helpful information for people who are applying for insurance or enrolling for the very first time.
There was a survey that was done that applied to last year's open enrollment. But is there any plan to do any sort of research to see the effectiveness of some of the outreach that's been done so far?
We do have plans for evaluations of outreach as well as other parts of our Marketplace operation in the near future. Those survey results that were conducted independently by the New York State Health Foundation found that over 90% of the people who had enrolled in 2014 were satisfied with their coverage. Most also reported that they would continue their coverage into 2015, and a very high percentage of the people who enrolled had been able to access medical services needed for themselves or their family.
When we talk about continuing coverage, a lot of people had the opportunity to make a change to their coverage in from the beginning of open enrollment until the first of the year. Did we see a lot of people renewing, or a lot of people just rolling over and sticking with what they already had?
We're still reviewing the data from renewal to make certain that we have been able to renew all of those who qualified, and we'll have that data shortly.
So over the last month, more than 225,000 previously uninsured New Yorkers were enrolled during this open enrollment. Those are the numbers as of midway last month, December 20th, last month at the close of business. And the majority of those people enrolled in Medicaid. And as I asked in the interview, I find that interesting because it was somewhat expected. A lot of people who didn't necessarily know the easiest way to get Medicaid and get in the insurance that they qualified for under the Affordable Care Act, they got set up. There were assisters, there were people who were there to help them, and they got signed up for insurance. They didn't have the money to pay for the insurance out of pocket. But there, that many people, that 142,000 people missed it last year. I found that very surprising.
A high number?
142,000. You know, I mean, it's, excuse me, yeah, 142,000. That's the majority of the people who signed up over that time period. And there were a lot of people that were signed up under private coverage. Last open enrollment, I don't have the numbers for this one. In the last open enrollment, 75% of the people who got private coverage qualified for some sort of assistance. So they got some tax breaks to help them pay for their pay for their premiums every month. They could say, you can take that either up front and you get the help every month, or you can take that on your taxes at the end of the year. We'll have plenty of stories on our website talking about taxes come tax time. Well, we're in it, but we'll probably be focusing on that when people start really thinking about that February, March, April. But there's just so much to this law. There's so much to the state exchange. There's so many things to talk about. The interesting thing, too, you know, when, because we don't want to just talk about policy and we talk about other things, there's a lot of innovation, too, that we talk about. Lot of visits to Strong and the other research institutions in our area talking about some of the things. One of the stories I was writing right now before you asked me to come in and talk to you right now is this link between HIV drugs and vascular disease. So people in the late 70s, 80s, when you were diagnosed with HIV, people weren't living very long. Very sad story, but people were dying pretty quickly. They were dying of a lot of times pneumonia, other sort of secondary infections that they couldn't fight off because they didn't have an immune system that was functioning because of the HIV. But now people are getting older. People are going into middle age and, you know, early, you know, into their 60s. And they are getting some of the diseases that you get in old age. Heart disease is one of them. Stroke, different things like that. That's normal when people are getting older to a certain extent. But it's at much higher rates for people who are on antiretroviral drugs. So we're kind of looking, is it because they've been living with HIV for so long?
Right.
Is it because of some sort of connection in inflammation in their life? Or does it have something to do with the fact that they're on this cocktail?
With the drugs, yeah.
Yeah. So just some early research, and we're looking at that, and we'll have stories about that over the next few days and looking into that as time goes on.
And by the way, how encouraging that here we are in 2015, and if you have an HIV diagnosis, you may have to be worried about vascular disease and other things in the future. I mean, a generation ago, you wouldn't have to worry about that because you would have been dead by then.
Well, yeah, and
it really is remarkable.
There's a lot of stories that I'm looking into doing as time goes on. I can't do it all at once, but Truvada a lot. I don't know if other people have been hearing this in the news. There, it is a prophylactic. It's a medication that you would take. It is very similar. It basically uses antiretroviral drugs that have been used in people who are living with AIDS. You take it before you contract the disease because maybe your partner is living with HIV and you want to make sure that you don't contract the virus. You can take this prophylactic antiretroviral, which is called Truvada. Because we're seeing these types of symptoms with people living long, it's not necessarily 100% known that the vascular disease is related to being on antiretrovirals or if it's something else. But looking at the people who are taking Truvada, are there risks? Are they making risks to their health for preventing it? Obviously, HIV is a risk as well. So
that's
kind of looking at all
of
these.
That's just one of the many stories you'll be covering in the weeks and months to come, yes?
That's right. That's right. And so we're hoping that people will check them out at our website. You'll find it at wxxi.org/ACA. You can check us out on Facebook or on Twitter. Our Twitter hashtag is #ACAWXXI. Send us an email if you've got any questions. ACAWXXI@WXXI.org. We still have our survey. We still want people to be taking that survey so we can get more questions for you on the website. We've got several questions and answers about just what our listeners, what normal people are saying, you know, what is happening with this and the ACA. We take those questions, we look into it, and we answer it in such a way that it works for a large section of our audience. So check that out, WXXI.org/ACA.
Thanks, Michelle Faust. Nice to see you as always. Short break, and we continue with our kind of a reporter's, it's not exactly a round table, because the table's not round, but they're not all here at the same time, but we're hitting a number of issues this hour with reporters here at WXXI and across New York State. That continues after the 60-second break. I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. Another one of my WXXI colleagues, Veronica Volk is your name.
Thanks, Evan. Good
nice to see you. Good afternoon, actually.
It's,
It feels like morning to you because this is going to be a later work day, and that's why I wanted you to pop in and tell us what you're working on today. This is a story that we had touched on over the last year, and things starting to move tonight. What's going on?
Yeah, well, okay, so Mayor Warren and Rochester Police Department Chief Simonelli announced back in April this plan for the police department reorganization. Now, what they're going to do is restructure officer assignment from this current two-division model to a five-section model. So the difference between two sections and five sections is obviously there's going to be more time for personal involvement for police officers in their communities. So they'll get to know people better, and the hope is that they'll be able to police better.
That's the goal.
Yes.
It has been controversial for a number of reasons, and I'm sure you will hear from some members of the community tonight, as there always are here. The meeting tonight is when?
Sure. It's from 6 to 7:30 at the Northeast Neighborhood Service Center office community room at 500 Norton Street. It's going to be an opportunity to meet five section captains, these new captains that they're going to have in each of these new districts. And another thing that this is going to do is be able to break up individual police beats from the current 22 individual beat to 37. So that's just another way that Warren and Simonelli are trying to get police more involved in their communities.
And we will certainly, for our listeners, especially in Rochester, but I think this is an important issue. I think no matter if you live in Rochester or not, city crime, city police relations should be important to all of us. We're going to be covering this in a lot more depth in the weeks to come. It sounds like the goal, Veronica, is that they want to be present. They want to be accessible to the community. I know that that's part of the goal tonight. And I guess that's part of the goal with five sections instead of two, with 37 beats instead of 22. They're just a little bit more presence to the community.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Of course they want more presence. But one of the criticisms of this is actually, is it going to affect the crime rate and the level of complaints? Because actually this two-division plan was implemented back in 2004 by now former Lieutenant Governor Bob Duffy.
Right.
And before that, it was seven sections, but that was during one of Rochester's peak crime years, 1982. So ever since then, the crime rate's been on kind of a steady, gradual decrease. So the question now is this actually going to affect crime rates, especially since it's going to cost the city upwards of $325,000 a year projected.
All right. Once again, before we let you go, the meeting tonight details?
It's at 6 to 7:30 at Northeast Neighborhood Service Center Office Community Room at 500 Norton Street.
And we'll hear your reports in the starting morning edition, I assume?
Morning edition, yes, and probably again on ACT later on.
Very good. All things considered in morning edition, Veronica Volk, who is just doing wonderful work for us. So great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Ed.
And thank you for stopping in studio sharing with us what you are working on today. And so I want to now turn our attention to an issue that's a little more far afield, but it is going to, I think it could definitely have impact here in Rochester and in Western New York. And if you're not a regular reader of Capital NY and you're interested in New York politics, I suspect maybe you should be. Bill Mahoney's on the line with us. He is a reporter with Capital NY. Bill, thank you for taking the time.
Having me.
Bill Mahoney and Dana Rubenstein wrote a piece called Silver's Actions Aid Clients of Second Firm. And this is Bill, this is a complex story. Sex scandals are easy to explain in one or two sentences. This one is not. But let me start with a simple question, and I don't know if it has an easy answer, but is Speaker Silver in trouble?
Well, we don't know for sure yet. He's being investigated by the FBI right now, which I think most people would view as problematic and wouldn't want to have that happen in their own personal lives, to be sure. We don't know the extent of what they're investigating or what he's being investigated for specifically. Apparently, they're looking into this outside law firm that he had where he was being paid for more than a decade for this work that wasn't being disclosed. We're still trying to suss out some of the details, which is what this story was about. But it seems he was getting paid for more than a decade by this law firm that specializes in this highly specific form of law, tax usury law, involving challenges to property tax assessments, which nobody had any knowledge of him being an expert in before. But he hasn't been disclosing this on his outside income disclosure forms during this time. So that certainly raised a lot of eyebrows when he has been submitting these legally signed documents to the state saying how he makes his money, and he's apparently been hiding the money from this firm. So that's what the FBI is looking into, and we're still waiting to learn more of the details going forward.
It's CapitalNewYork.com, and again, the name of the story is Silver's Actions Aid Clients of Second Firm. I want to quote from Bill Mahoney and Dana Rubenstein's story. Quote, it was the first time the public learned Sheldon Silver, who has successfully blocked nearly every effort at tort reform in the Assembly, worked not only for a personal injury law firm, but also for a real estate firm. It's not clear what precisely Silver did for that second firm. That's part of what federal authorities are investigating, as Bill has been telling us. But Bill, if he's paid by a second firm, and he wasn't disclosing that he was getting paid by the second firm, the easy assumption is that he didn't want folks to know that he was getting paid by the second firm because he was in a position of legislative power to do things to benefit them. Is there evidence that Sheldon Silver, as Speaker, was doing things to benefit this firm, their clients, etc.?
Well, it does seem one of the themes that we looked at in the story is how he has a history of being fairly moderate on issues involving real estate tax assessments, despite the fact that his conference, the Assembly Democrats, probably are the most liberal in Albany and have been for decades in terms of issues like that. He came under a lot of fire last year for his role in renewing 421As, which is a specific form of tax breaks for projects that I believe are limited just to New York City. But when that was up for their renewal a couple years ago, it came out that he had snuck in a couple breaks for a few specific developers within New York City. And the Moreland Commission, which had been appointed by Governor Cuomo a couple years ago to investigate corruption in Albany, had begun to examine that. They were shut down. It's feasible that U.S. Attorney Prue Bharara has picked up that investigation. Where they left off, we don't know that piece for sure. But that's one example of how he's played a role in steering tax breaks to real estate companies in the past decade, while he's been getting paid by a firm that makes its money for getting tax breaks for real estate companies in New York City. So it seems like there is a lot of overlap between the legislative activities he's made and the decisions he's made in the past decade and what he's been doing for this firm, which we still don't know the details of. He could just be working as a secretary for a couple days a week taking phone calls, which is unlikely, obviously. But,
probably unlikely. You
know, but we have no idea. You know, he could be being paid a lot of money for doing no work, or he could be steering business to this firm from people who might have business for the state. But nobody's ever been able to examine this in the past because we didn't know that this was happening until 8 years ago.
Well, and you used a phrase I'd like you to explain it in a little bit more detail. You mentioned that Sheldon Silver snuck in breaks for some of these clients. How do you sneak in a break, for example?
I've been in Albany for a decade now, and I've read a lot of pieces of legislation, but anybody who picks up a piece of tax break legislation, it takes a very special skill to read that and make sense of what's happening. If you're offering tax breaks to developers, you can't go in there and say, hey, this project happening on Main Street, they get a tax break. It's usually limited to something like block 17 of lot 4 within this city, and unless you really happen to know the real estate markets, it's tough to figure out which projects are getting these breaks. And when the Assembly was set to vote on this, apparently they briefed the Assembly Democrats at his conference on what was in this bill. But when it came up for a vote, they said, oh, there's some minor changes. But it turned out people didn't realize until after the fact, in many cases, that these minor changes are actually breaks for a few specific mega projects within New York City. One of them, run by XTEL Development, a large real estate company in New York, got $35 million from Speaker Silver's actions. And it turns out that they had also given a lot of money to both Assembly Democrats and to Governor Cuomo before this bill was signed into law. But most of the members had no idea. They picked up the bill, they tried to read through it and identify these cosmetic changes, but you need this very special skill to make sense of what's actually going on. And they were told by Silver staffers, hey, this is nothing big, don't worry about it. And that's all they had to go off of. And a lot of them then voted for it, and some of them said they regretted it and were angry, and were angry with Speaker Silver for his role in these specific breaks.
It's hard to understand how he's going to explain it, but I want to get to that in a second. You mentioned that the Moreland Commission had waded into this territory before being shut down by the governor almost a year ago. And I want to quote from that, because you write about that in the piece regarding what the Moreland Commission had to say. You write, you quote from them, quote, "Our investigation continues and we draw no premature conclusions on whether the extension of the 421A tax abatement to these specific properties involved any improper action. But it is clear that the combination of very large campaign contributions and very narrowly targeted benefits to those same donors creates an appearance of impropriety." So, as you say, Bill, Preet Bharara, U.S. attorney, picks it up. We know that behind closed doors, he has been doing a lot of work. We don't exactly know what. His office have anything to say about this?
They haven't weighed in publicly, as far as I'm aware, about this specific program. What came out last week is that they were looking into Silver's outside employment and this secret law firm that I had mentioned earlier. But in terms of whether or not they're investigating these specific tax breaks, I'd be surprised if they weren't. The Moreland Commission began digging up a lot of evidence about the overlap between campaign contributions and specific companies that got these tax breaks, but we don't know for sure. Often the FBI isn't always forthcoming with what they're planning on doing in the future, what they're working on until they've got some solid evidence that might lead to an indictment going forward.
Sheldon Silver himself or his office have said what about all of this?
I've seen a number of stories written a couple myself, and they seem to be declining comments. They're not answering any questions.
What about colleagues of Sheldon Silver? And again, I've mentioned this hour that I have heard more in the last few weeks from various sources in politics. And I'm not talking about just Democrats, and certainly not just Republicans who might oppose Sheldon Silver. I'm talking about people of all stripes who are hearing rumblings that this is a very serious matter, to be ready for some potentially surprising outcomes, et cetera. Now, no one knows for sure. Are you hearing anything from colleagues of Sheldon Silver on this?
Well, it seems as of now they're being quiet. There have been no formal charges or anything like that brought. It just came out that the FBI is investigating this, which is serious. But I'm sure the FBI investigates a lot of things that don't wind up bearing any fruit and don't result in any criminal charges. As of now, his Assembly Democrats are still very much in support of him. I think since we've actually started speaking today, Speaker Silver was formally reelected into this position with only one Democratic vote in opposition. Part of this is due to the power that Assembly speakers have.
Yep.
In Albany, they get to decide everything from what committee posts people get to how many staff members they get to, even what parking spaces they get. So if somebody wanted to make noise, if there was a Assembly Democrat who had maybe been here for 20 years, had some seniority and wanted to make a run for the speaker himself, and if he tried to do this and then failed, that would probably mean that, you know, he'd lose all his staffers, he'd lose his extra paycheck coming from getting a committee chair, and they'd lose their parking spot. And, you know, there are horror stories of somebody who ran against Sheldon Silver and his colleagues would get five parking spots, 5 to 10 minute walk away from the Capitol. While this member then got one that was like a mile and a half away. And there are stories that have circulated like that in the past, just how much power the Assembly Speaker wields in distributing resources, that it takes a lot of confidence to challenge the Speaker. So even if some members are disgruntled, it's unlikely that they're going to make any serious attempts to overthrow him unless they are very confident that they can get a majority of votes to do so.
Before I let you go, Bill, we're heading into a legislative session now. We're going to hear on January 21st, the State of the State. Does this hanging over Sheldon Silver's head impact the state's ability to conduct business in 2015?
Well, to be fair, it's been a long time since we haven't had potential criminal charges hanging over the heads of
the top leader. That's fair. It's a fair point. Yep.
It's, you know, it seems like every other month we get a state legislator led away in handcuffs. So it's not that much on par for the course. If there are criminal charges and he is indicted, that would obviously change the landscape quite dramatically. He's been in power for 2 decades now, and it's tough to picture anybody else in the assembly running that chamber without the experience that he has. So that could certainly lead to more gridlock going forward, and it could create chaos. But as of now, it seems like the Assembly Democrats are solidly behind him, at least publicly, and he's still going to play a role in negotiating the big projects like the budget every year. And until this situation changes, I don't think this has a significant effect in terms of what he can do in his role as Assembly Speaker.
I think that's a smart analysis. And Bill, finally, when it comes to this kind of a story, again, a sex scandal is easy to understand. You can tell it in a sentence or two. This is murky. There's a lot of legalese. It is technical. We're talking about 421A and breaks snuck into heavily sort of legislation with heavy legal language and questions about impropriety of clients of firms benefiting. It's easy to lose people, but I think these stories are just as important, if not more so, than sort of the glamorous headlines, et cetera. What's the biggest challenge when you're writing a story like this in terms of distilling it for the public while also maintaining understanding the complexity yourself?
Well, a lot of it is just figuring out what's going on. There's still a lot of unanswered questions. The details of which firms are getting tax breaks, that's often not very clear. If you look at, for example, the list of his firm's clients, they're representing real estate properties, and a lot of these just have vaguely titled names like Bill LLC, and it's tough to figure out who's actually behind these. And a lot of the business in the state, surprisingly in 2015, a lot of what you see in terms of identifying who actually owns specific buildings, there's no simple way to do that. That's usually for every single building or property in the state of New York. Oftentimes, if you're talking about something more than just a home buyer, you've got to work through a network of LLCs and corporate subsidiaries to figure out who's actually involved. And that's something that I do think takes a lot of time. And who knows? There's a lot about this I still haven't figured out, even with the data sets that I've been working on. So who knows? There might be more findings going forward.
I'll post the story to my Twitter account, at Evan Dawson, after the program today. And you can find it at capitalnewyork.com. Silver's Actions, Aid Clients of Second Firm. And again, I know it's a dense story, but Bill Mahoney and Dana Rubenstein have done a very good job helping us sort through the current landscape that faces Sheldon Silver. And there's a lot of rumbling that this could get very serious very soon. So, Bill, thank you for taking the time to help distill it for our listeners. And I hope to talk to you again as more develops here.
Sounds good. Thank you for having me.
Bill Mahoney, CapitalNewYork.com, Capital NY, a daily read for many of us in the industry. And they cover really New York City, Albany, but also New York State issues. And they do it very, very well. Now, if you're wondering what some of the top leaders in the Assembly outside Sheldon Silver have said, for example, Brian Kolb, minority leader, Republican, of course, has said he wants more of an explanation, that Sheldon Silver owes an explanation to voters, taxpayers, and his colleagues where his income is coming from in this second firm, exactly what he did for this second firm, and what his relationship is with them, especially in light of the fact that it appears that New York State legislative practice has benefited clients of this firm. So Brian Kolb wants more of an explanation. I spoke briefly with Joe Morelli's office this morning, of course, the majority leader, and that's a position that is appointed by Speaker Sheldon Silver. Joe Morelli maintains his support for Sheldon Silver, and beyond that, they tell me that he really can't talk about what is a legal matter. And I understand that. I mean, I don't think that's a cop-out. I think right now there are very serious legal questions hanging on this, with the FBI involved, a Preet Bharara, U.S. attorney potentially involved. And so Joe Morelli is not going to come out and make a comment about something that is clearly being investigated on a number of fronts. But it could impact him. If Sheldon Silver is somehow removed as Speaker of the Assembly, it does not mean that Joe Morelli, who is the Assembly Majority Leader, becomes Speaker. There would have to be a new election. Would Joe Morelli be a candidate for that position? Certainly he would, and certainly he would be the leading upstate candidate. But you know that there would be a downstate pull that would be very strong as well. So you're not going to see Joe Morelli campaigning, I don't think, for Sheldon Silver to have any bad outcome here. And for everything I can tell, Joe Morelli maintains a good relationship with Sheldon Silver. But this is one to watch. This is one to watch as we head into a legislative session. And as Bill Mahoney said, unfortunately, it's not new to New York State to see legal questions, investigations, possible indictments looming, and there isn't a whole lot here that looks good for Sheldon Silver. But maybe there's something he's not telling us. And when a member of a powerful political body is choosing not to answer questions like this, it makes you wonder, but you have to try to reserve the benefit of the doubt until we hear more. And whether we hear more from Sheldon Silver or his office or Preet Bharara or the FBI, I suspect we're going to hear more before the winter is out, and we'll see if that means a change in leadership in New York State. Been a long time. Sheldon Silver, long one of the most powerful people in this state. And that would be a fascinating set of events to see happen in motion. But we'll continue to follow that for you here on Connections and on WXXI News. Short break, and then we're going to have a continuation of a discussion that kind of started yesterday when it comes to Latino issues in Rochester. Today we're talking politics. Latino representation in politics in the United States does not nearly match the population of Latinos. How about Rochester? How about mobilizing votes? We tackle those issues with your participation next, right here on member-supported public radio.